Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan, and today is going to be a different kind of show. Usually I interview some really outstanding, cutting-edge, frontier person in the field of mental health. But today I'm going to talk for an hour, just as if you were here with me in my office or listening to me at a conference, and I'm going to talk about psychopharmacology and drugs. I don't do this enough, folks. I don't enough just take the time to use this marvelous hour on PRN-FM, and I am grateful to PRN-FM, to just tell the world my knowledge, to share my knowledge with the world about various subjects. And what inspired this today is the recent publication of a new article of mine. It actually came out in the January issue of the Journal of Contemporary Psychotherapy. And my article is called Rational Principles of Psychopharmacology for Therapists, Healthcare Providers, and Clients. And I could add, and any citizen who cares about what's happening with the massive drugging of our children, our old people, and folks in general. So I'm going to use that article as a basis for my presentation today, knowing that for scientific citations, you can go right to the article, which is online at my website at www.bregan.com. Just plug in BREGGIN.com, and you'll see up at the top a reference to Rational Principles of Psychopharmacology. And why do we need rational principles? I mean, that's kind of an odd way to write a science, sort of rational principles of gravitation or something along those lines. Well, the fact is that what passes as psychopharmacology today is hardly anything other than drug company propaganda. The people who write about, speak about, testify about, and treat people in regard to psychopharmacology are basically coming from a drug company orientation. The epidemic is so widespread, it's really hard to describe. First, we can start with the vulnerable people, because the psychopharmacology basis is really an octopus now. I call it the psychopharmaceutical complex. It's an octopus with tentacles run by the drug industry, of which, by the way, the profession of psychiatry is but one of the minor tentacles that sort of has the robes of authority and lets this octopus infiltrate, because the psychiatrists are but a fraction of the actual prescribing that goes on in the area of psychopharmacology, the psychiatric drugs. Your pediatrician, your GP, your surgeon, your OBGYN, and increasingly your nurse practitioner, your physician's assistant, and in some places your clinical psychologist who's taken a few courses and gotten licensed under the state. These are folks that are just from across the spectrum who are dumping these toxic substances into the mouths of our citizens. And they always get the more vulnerable ones first. They know in the pharmaceutical industry, these tentacles, they know how to smell the blood in the water. So who do they go after? They go after the children in our society who are really totally unable to consent to what's going on. They're always voluntary, and their parents aren't informed properly about what the drugs are doing. So we have those involuntary folks. Indeed, almost everybody getting a psychiatric drug today, including any of you who haven't studied my work or Peter Gerch's work or Bob Whitaker's work. I mean, you're in the dark about what the drugs are doing, so you're involuntary. But the elderly are a big subject that are abused, physically and mentally impaired people, whether it's a backache that eventually leads you to be put on Neurontin or some other really psychiatric-type drug. The military, of course, they are just huge numbers. Some people estimate up to a third of active-duty military, and some of our sections of the war are on heavy psychiatric drugs, no supervision, out in the field. Our veterans, that's a huge scandal. I mean, if you're a veteran with a so-called emotional problem or psychiatric problem, you might be on up to 10 or 15 drugs. I've been involved in malpractice cases against the VA where people have been just drugged from being just men feeling a little tired or a little stressed coming back home after the war and drugged into being severely impaired individuals whose lives have been stolen from them by the VA. Men and women who are stressed economically, of course, are easy game. They go to the doctor, they say they're tired or anything remotely resembling being stressed, and onto the psych drugs. Single mothers and working women with children are good targets. There's a lot of marketing toward the women, and we now know that at least 20% of our women now are on antidepressants, and that's only at any one time. Probably half or more of women, maybe much more than half, are one time or another diagnosed and put on a medication. If you start looking beyond the antidepressants to things like Xanax and the other benzos and the mood stabilizers and the stimulants to overcome the sedation and so on. So we're looking at a giant system, an octopus that just reaches wherever it can and has not as yet been slowed down. Now, there's a bunch of myths that this system has promoted that have really grabbed the imagination of the public. And the biggest myth of all is the biochemical imbalance. That's all a doctor has to tell you, is you've got a biochemical imbalance, and he's bypassed all the concepts of what really causes stress. Loss of loved ones, conflict in marriage, difficulty with children, job dissatisfaction, child abuse whose symptoms are surfacing later in life. All that's bypassed. There's no theoretical discussion. There's no look at the underpinnings of human nature and human experience. That's a biochemical imbalance. Take your drug. And beyond that, which the drug companies don't have to explain to anyone, as long as they can say biochemical imbalance, is the whole medical model of human suffering, where we can diagnose complex psychological, social, emotional problems with derivatives and everything from trauma to the increase in depression and suicide during hard economic times. All this is bypassed. The most common reason people tend to come for therapy, I think, are frustration, loss, pain, and suffering in love relationships. Nothing paid attention to. Now, your wife has a biochemical imbalance. You have a biochemical imbalance. You're both, and maybe your kids too. You see families being with 5 and 6 people on psychiatric drugs, and then their extended family as well. It's a bizarre situation, and everybody's heard the words biochemical imbalance. Then along comes somebody like Ronald Pies, who was a former editor of Clinical Psychiatric News, which is the most widely circulated psychiatric newspaper. Certainly it is next to the newspaper that everybody has to buy, belongs to the American Psychiatric Association. And it goes to a lot more people than just psychiatrists. Ronald Pies came out and said, well, this is ridiculous. The only people who bring up biochemical imbalances are people who are trying to ridicule psychiatry, because no reasonable psychiatrist ever believed in a biochemical imbalance. And you can find the cite from like the quote in my paper that's on my desk top, I would say, because that's where it is for me. It's on my website at bregan.com, Rational Principles of Psychopharmacology. Well, It's news, of course, to the millions and millions of patients who are still being told they have biochemical imbalances that, according to Ronald Pies, no one's ever believed in it. I don't know what even to make about out of Ronald Pies' statement, other than I think they're getting really anxious there at the top because this is now, there have been so many books and articles. I was probably among the first, maybe the first, to really attack the biochemical imbalance theories back in toxic psychiatry in the early 1990s. But I think it's everywhere now being criticized. So what I want to do now is shift over to talking with you, maybe a little more slowly, about three basic principles of psychopharmacology. Now, my work has had certainly widespread influence. People are much more aware of the damaging effects of psychiatric drugs. Many more people now have the courage to write about it. But some of the basic principles in my writing, people are having trouble just facing up to. They may even admit to the brain damaging effects of the drugs and write about them courageously, but they won't look at the basic principles that I'm going to share with you now, which will put you ahead of the game, ahead of understanding these drugs compared to most people in the world. And again, these are all footnoted and described in Rational Principles of Psychopharmacology. The first basic principle is that all psychiatric drugs, in fact, all psychiatric interventions, including psychosurgery and lobotomy, but we'll focus on the drugs, all of them disable the brain. They all disable the brain, and that's how they work. They have no other way of working. We don't know any substances that are put into the brain that make it function better. The brain has evolved over trillions of years, going way back to the first or second cell that started to multiply. Real soon after, we had worms with things that looked like brains, and then, now all kinds of creatures with brains. Well, that whole evolution has evolved the human brain, which is the most complex thing in the universe. Your brain's more complex than the entire rest of the universe, believe it or not. That's why there's no Einstein of the brain, not even a Newton or a Kepler of the brain. I mean, there's just no great scientist of the brain because no one's yet figured out its basic operating system. No one's given us that flash of insight which takes us to a new level of understanding the brain. So the idea that some substance get in there and make it better is foolhardy. In fact, it's really not even how the drug companies can approach the problem. If the drug companies want to develop a drug that is going to become a psychiatric drug, they can't look for a drug that will improve the functioning of the animal's brain because they have to start with the animal because there is no such thing. And if there were, it wouldn't even be a way to measure it. So what do? They find a substance that disrupts the normal function of a brain. And in this case, a mammalian brain, usually a mouse or a rat. And they find out it disrupts function by seeing behavioral changes that are always negative. I mean, you don't make the animal smarter. Maybe the animal gets more hyper or more sluggish or more sleepy. And they know something about the drug as having a psychoactive effect. And then they go ahead, or maybe it also makes the animal more dulled to punishment, for example, whatever gross thing they're looking at. And then they grind up the rat's brain, and based on their initial estimates of what the drug might do, usually based on previous studies of animals, computerized searching on the molecule and so on, they look for where the drug is impairing the brain. For example, the SSRIs like Prozac and Zoloft and Celexa, all of those drugs, they were given, the SSRIs, they were given to animals to demonstrate that they block the removal of serotonin from a synapse in the brain. The theory was that we're going to argue to the public and the profession that you've got too much serotonin in your brain, which is ridiculous, far-fetched, and unproven, period. But we're going to prove you got too much serotonin in your brain. It's hyperactive serotonin. And we are going to block its removal from the brain. So these are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. It just means they're blocking the removal of serotonin from the synapse in the brain. Now, from the beginning, Eli Lilly, whose Prozac was the first one of these, knew that they were lying in their PR because they knew that with the very first dose of the drug, which indeed blocked some of the removal of the serotonin, that the brain cell responded from after the first dose and said, well, I won't produce any serotonin. I'll fix you. I don't like this intoxication you're causing, this disturbance. Then it went on and said, and while you're trying to block the removal, I'm going to make my removal apparatus stronger. Oh, and by the way, while you're trying to flood the brain and overstimulate me, I'm going to dial back my receptors for serotonin. So I've got all these mechanisms that are going to stop your drug effect. And indeed, there's no evidence that there's any increase in serotonin in the brain from these drugs. What you do find evidence for is that there's a weird redistribution of where the serotonin synapses are working. Your brain's been thrown out of whack. And by the way, which they don't like to mention, it's also throwing out of whack your entire brain because serotonin is everywhere in the brain, pretty much everywhere. It's very widespread. And it's in your spinal cord. It's in your spinal fluid, the breakdown products. And there's serotonin receptors in your bloodstream and in your gut. I mean, it's just ridiculous to think you're doing something specific to the brain that's good for it. You're simply disrupting throughout the body the whole serotonin system with multiple adverse effects and no specific good effect. You're disabling the brain. Now, why would somebody say that disabling their brain is good? Why would a patient think that? Well, very honestly, not too many patients actually think so. What they experience initially is either a high, in which case they say that the disability from the antidepressant is really great. They don't know it's a disability because I'm feeling better than ever. But I can tell you in many legal cases I do and have done that one of the most bad signs you can see in a medical record is when the patient comes in for the second visit after the drug, the antidepressant is given, patient says, Doc, I've never felt better in my life. Now, the doctor puts 3 exclamation points. He's a miracle worker there. But actually, that's terrible. My God, what does it mean if a drug so transformed your brain that you're thinking you feel better than you have ever in your life? Well, it's actually the beginning of hypomania and mania. And quite often, I see that. My eyes light up because I may be doing a legal case where somebody's had a manic episode and killed somebody, or somebody's had a manic episode and sold all their personal goods and is trying to somehow recoup from that, or caused a criminal act and is trying to find an explanation. And this is what will come up right away. The drug was a miracle because it was the beginning of a manic episode. Mostly people just get tweaked with that little euphoria, and then they go from, and I'm sure this has happened to many of my listeners, just remember, you are not to blame. This happens to so many people, and I'll explain to you later in the hour why you didn't know it was even happening to you. So here you are. You go around looking for one antidepressant after another, hoping to get back that wonderful feeling. It may come back briefly, but it doesn't last because the brain fights against it. If it does last, you end up in a mental hospital or in jail with a manic episode. Now, so that's one way the antidepressants hook people. They convince them that they can make them happy. The second thing, and by far the overwhelming effect of the antidepressants, is they numb everything. They numb love, sexuality, passion. And of course, if you're going through some horror show of a conflict in your marriage or with your children or at work or this resurfacing of childhood abuse, whatever you're going through, and you get anesthetized and no one tells you that's exactly what's happening, of course it's going to feel better. And sometimes when folks come in as a couple, I love to work with couples, couple comes in and the husband says, I've been better, and his voice is flat. I've been better on the antidepressants for a year. I don't know why my wife's bringing me in here. And the wife says, because, honey, you're not acting like you love me anymore, and you don't even feel caring toward the children. And have you noticed, dear, you don't even pet the dog as much as you used to. And the person doesn't know it. But what they feel is less emotion. And because they've been bamboozled by the lie of biochemical imbalances, bamboozled by the prescriber, probably isn't a psychiatrist, they just want to stay in that place. Or they try to come off, and this can happen with any psychiatric drug, and they have a withdrawal reaction, which so horrifies them and convinces them that they are really crazy, that they go back on the antidepressant. And the doctor says, I told you you needed to stay on it the rest of your life. He says that even though there aren't any rest of your life studies, but except the ones, for example, that I've been doing and Peter Gertz is doing and that Bob Whitaker has been doing, all of which show a decline in the quality of life and even shortened lifespan. Whoa, it's a lot to take. I know, it's a lot to take. So the first principle is the brain disabling principle, which is that all psychiatric interventions disable the brain, and it's just a matter of whether somebody, you or your doctor or your family, thinks that that disabling effect is better. Then you feel compelled to take the drug, or somebody compels you emotionally or indeed physically to take the drug. The antipsychotics provide an even easier model, and it's the model around the drugs around which I developed the brain disabling principle in my seminal medical books, the most recent being Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry. But you can get all of this in my article, very short form. You can get it in a longer form in my newest book, my newest medical book, which is Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. Gives you all this information in the first half, then in the second half talks you how to come off the drugs. When I first started looking into this issue of brain disabling principle, and I was struggling with it, wondering why no one else had actually talked about this, I went back to one of my old textbooks, and in it was a drawing. And the drawing was about the effect of antipsychotic drugs, at least that's what I thought it was, on the nervous system, because the drawing was of a human head with a brain in it, and then the outline of the dopamine system of nerves, which go from deep in the brain in a place called the basal ganglia, onto the frontal lobes, thus being key, a key nerve trunk for frontal lobe function. And it was indicating that this giant system to your frontal lobes was blocked by the antipsychotic drugs. The original ones were Thorazine and Haldol and Melaril, and now we have Zyprexa and Risperdal and Risperdone and Vega, and so on. So I looked at the drawing and I said to myself, my gosh, they're going to point out that these drugs are lobotomizing because they're blocking the function of the frontal lobes. But instead, underneath was a caption that said, because the antipsychotic drugs work on dopamine, we believe that schizophrenics have basically too much dopamine. And so it's blocking the dopamine. Well, This was a stupid idea from the beginning because it's blocking dopamine in everybody and it's having the same effects on everybody, producing indifference and apathy. It produces it in dogs. I once, by mistake, gave one of my dogs an antipsychotic drug because it was the vet's anti-nausea drug. My dog was vomiting in the car when we drove. I had a very independent dog named Ted. He had a mind of his own. He thought about thinking. You say, come. Actually, I think it was Blue. Ted was more obedient. Blue. You'd say to Blue, come. And he'd stop and think about it. Or he'd want to get ready to chase a squirrel. He'd stop and think about it. He asked him to come in the car. He stopped and thought about it and said no. So we gave him the anti-nausea pill. I hadn't looked it up yet. And our daughter, Allie, took the dog out to the car to get ready for the trip. And she came back in and she said, Daddy, she was quite young at the time, Daddy, Blue just jumped right into the car when I asked him. And then it struck me, oh, my God, we've given him a docility pill. And I looked it up, and the anti-nausea pill, as too many of them are, for humans too, in particular Reglan in humans, metoclopramide or Reglan, they're antipsychotic drugs that block dopamine because that also blocks the nausea center. So even in dogs, these drugs produce the same effects, docility, apathy, indifference. They'll do what you're told. They're used in the Russian prison system, the so-called the psychopolitical prisons. They created a diagnosis called sluggish schizophrenia so that they could give every dissident who was obviously crazy because they lived in communist Russia and didn't think it was great, the USSR. They used in old age homes, prisons, any way you want to control people. They put in darts to stop wild animals dead in their tracks so you can operate on them without necessarily even anesthetizing them any further because they're so docile. Well, then you can anesthetize them some more. In veterinary medicine, they can be given, and I think that this is a suitable use of them, the only suitable use I've ever seen. They can be given to your dog before your dog is given what could be more shocking to his system, which is the drug that's going to kill him by stopping his heart. So you give him a little antipsychotic drug, and the dog becomes lethargic and quiet. And I'm talking about 30 seconds, and then you can give him the next drug. So the antipsychotic drugs, it's ridiculous to claim they have any specificity for any disorder. They simply disable the brain by giving a chemical lobotomy. There's no question about it. So while the SSRIs are disabling your brain by messing around with serotonin, trying to jack up serotonin, which doesn't turn out to be good for the brain, the antipsychotics are disabling the brain by suppressing dopamine, which doesn't do a lot of good. In fact, the brain fights back again. And when it fights back, it actually produces bizarre physical abnormalities as the brain tries to fight against the drug. That becomes tardive dyskinesia. Produces bizarre mental phenomena. It's called tardive psychosis. So the brain's always fighting back against the disability. It's not welcoming and saying, you did better by me. It's not saying to the Prozac or the citalopram or whatever other SSRI you've taken, your Paxil, you know, and so on, or other drugs even, other antidepressants like Wellbutrin. It's not saying, guys, you're right, this is great, you've corrected my imbalance. The antidepressants are fighting back, causing violence and suicide and other severe aberrations. Well, the antipsychotics are fighting back and causing psychosis and then terrible physical abnormalities. So those are two of the most basic drugs. We know exactly how the stimulants work, although everybody denies it. And I actually, you know, was the expert on adverse effect of stimulant drugs at the big ADHD and stimulants conference, big federal conference. in the 1990s, 1998, I think. And the head of the conference, who was the nation's expert, didn't know that we knew how the stimulants worked. He hadn't read any of the literature. It was a complete surprise to him. The stimulants, by their multiple effects of disrupting dopamine and serotonin and epinephrine and acetylcholine, there's multiple disruptive effects. They do two things. And a lot of it has to do with disruption of the basal ganglia, but we don't have the specifics down as well as we do for the antipsychotics and the antidepressants. They cause a crushing of all spontaneous behavior. So a monkey, a chimp, real near to us, a chimp, they like kids. You know, they want to do all the things kids do. And if you give a stimulant, like the methylphenidate products like Focalin and Ritalin, or the Adderall, or the amphetamine products like Adderall and so on. If you give these to these chimps, they stop exploring, they stop running around, they stop socializing, which is key. They don't groom each other. And the second thing is they become OCD, obsessive compulsive. They pick at their own skin instead of the complexity of lovingly, you know, fondling and cleaning the skin and picking it clean of your neighboring chimp. And they may play with pebbles instead of trying to do something more interesting, may chew on the bars. Well, this behavior of crushing spontaneity and causing OCD makes the teacher, and sometimes the parent, especially when they're misled by the doctors that this is good, it makes the teachers feel like the kid's better because the kid is no longer throwing spitballs. It's mostly boys who get these drugs. No longer throwing spitballs or poking Janie or sending notes around the classroom or wiggling in his seat because he's bored or anxious or hungry or whatever else is causing the behavior behind in class. I mean, there's a million things that cause kids to get labeled ADHD. It's not a disorder. It's just symptoms of distress or discomfort or something like that in a classroom that annoys the teacher. It's only if it annoys the teacher. This is the sad truth. ADHD is just a list of things that demand attention from teachers. So now there's no longer a demand because the child's spontaneity has been crushed, and in a compulsive way he's writing down whatever she puts on the board. Does this help? None of this helps. I'll talk about that a little bit later in the what I am now into the second half hour. So the stimulants crush spontaneity. What do the benzos do? All of these sedative drugs, including closely related drugs like Sonata and Ambien. Well, again, we know their mechanism pretty well. They jack up a system that's everywhere in the brain called GABA, capital G-A-B-A, capital letters, gamma-aminobutyric acid. It jacks this up, which causes sleep, and ultimately will cause coma, and you can do surgery. Most surgical anesthetics are based on benzos. And you can give enough of a benzo, most of them, to put a person into a coma suitable for surgery. If you bag breathed them, gave them oxygen, do surgery on them. So all the benzos are doing is nothing specific for anxiety. It's just another lie. And anybody should know it. It's surgical anesthesia, for God's sakes. So what you're doing is you're creating a continuum of increasing sedation. First, you take the edge off things, and one of the first edges to go is anxiety. And besides, you're focused on the anxiety, not on the speed of your thinking. So you notice the anxiety is gone, not necessarily noticing so is the speed of your thinking or your short-term memory. You're just noticing the anxiety is gone. That's normal. I mean, that's what a person's going to do. They want to get rid of the anxiety. And then if you take more and more, you scoop them, you put you to sleep so that all of them can be used, pretty much all of them. There's different marketing techniques, but most of them can be used for sleep medications. So that's all we're doing with the benzos. Doesn't matter whether you give them to an animal or a human, you're putting them to sleep. And the mild version of sleep is where you feel less of your alertness functioning. You take the edge off the frontal lobes, And with that goes one of the highest, most subtle human functions, which is anxiety. The brain fights back. Once again, never forget this. This should be one of the principles. Make it the fourth principle, I'm going to tell you. The brain fights back. So what happens eventually is you end up in insomnia. It's almost inevitable. And increased anxiety. That's inevitable. So if you take these drugs for sometimes a few days, sometimes a few weeks, you begin to have more anxiety and need more of the drug. And you get more insomnia and need more of the drug. And the good old vicious cycle or circle develops. The truth is the same with the mood stabilizers. Most of them now are anti-seizure drugs. Why are they anti-seizure drugs like Depakote or Tegretol? Well, because how do anti-seizure drugs work? They slow the brain, overall brain down. They can't find the specific seizure center and affect it. They don't get at the specific scar or problem area. They just slow the whole brain down and you have less seizures. Good treatment for seizures, but it's a problem for both seizure patients and psychiatric patients. Now, with psychiatric patients, the results are devastating. Lithium, as your model of this most looked at, is causing long-term a drastic neurologic dilapidation in patients. It is causing memory loss, cognitive decline. It's a disaster. And again, all of this is documented on my website, documented in Rational Principles of Psychopharmacology. And it's also documented in more detail in my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, the first half. Now, the second principle is intoxication and anosognosia, and that will take us a little less time. Intoxication and anosognosia, I don't know why somebody else has already come up with that. It means not knowing you're intoxicated. And I call it, for the specific purpose here, of medication spellbinding. You see it with all psychoactive substances. You see it also with brain damage of all kind. Persons tend to deny the degree of their brain injury. So when the doctor sees a patient who's at ECT and is complaining of memory loss and says it's all in your mind, actually the memory loss is even worse than the patient's reporting. Always worse than the patient's reporting in my experience. Because the patients really can't bear to face the degree of loss, or because there's some mechanism in the brain that just protects us from knowing about how harmed we are. But at any rate, it exists. So when you try to stop your drunk friend from driving, like the ads tell you to, your drunk friend is not going to think he's too drunk to drive. He's actually going to tell you he can drive better than ever when he's drunk because he knows he's drunk and he focuses harder. If you go to a party where people are smoking dope and you're not, the jokes aren't as funny as they think. The cookies don't taste as good as they think. And if you're in a room with somebody who's doing LSD, they cannot fly. So, medication spellbinding makes you unaware of the degree of your impairment, and it makes you think you're better than ever in many ways. This happens with all psychiatric drugs. I have multiple legal cases in which people on psychiatric drugs have done the strangest, weirdest things, the most horrible and damaging things, without thinking for a moment that it's caused by the drug. Violence, people commonly commit violence on the SSRIs, or as in a recent case of mine, an elderly man on multiple psychiatric drugs. And other drugs, just had a lot of drugs, but even the non-psychiatric ones for his bladder and his hypertension and so on, also had psychoactive effects. Now I was able to show that even the physician's desk reference, which has the drug labels for seven or eight of the drugs he was getting, pointed out either there was a risk with the elderly or that there was a risk with delirium or a risk with psychosis, and these all came together and he committed a terrible act of violence on the drug. But he didn't know it at the time that it was driven by the drug. His wife did, but he didn't. His wife did. and was able to get him help and eventually got to me to help him. I'll tell you about that later at another time. Similarly, people will get depressed on many psychiatric drugs, not just the black box warnings for antidepressants. We have black box warnings now for the mood stabilizers and the anti-seizure drugs for suicide. There's a suicide warning on one of the children's drugs. So, you know, it's really a lot of drugs. The benzos can make you depressed and suicidal. I had a case in court that I won where the Halcyon, which is a benzo sleeping pill, causes suicide. I say I won. I was the expert. I won in the sense of no other expert in the country who's willing or able to testify the way I did. So what does the person think when they're committing suicide? They don't think it must be my Halcyon. I've only been feeling it for 2 weeks, suicidal, or it's not my Celexa or my Wellbutrin. It's not my Xanax, my benzos. It's not my Ativan. They think it's my wife that's making me depressed, or life is making me depressed, or my neighbor's making me feel violent toward them. They don't have any idea where it's coming from. So medication spellbinding is this incredibly important principle that people who are under the spell of drugs don't realize how damaging they are and often attribute to them great and even magical properties. And that will help you understand addiction too, because severe alcoholics don't realize that they are ruining the quality of their lives. They think they need alcohol. The cocaine addict doesn't think that he's destroying himself with his cocaine. In fact, he'll do anything to get the cocaine. He'll do anything. He may even commit violence. He'll certainly steal to get his cocaine off. And not all addicts, of course. He has no idea that he is the victim of the cocaine. He thinks the cocaine's all that's getting him through life. One time I was giving a talk at a law school in Washington, D.C., when I used to live there. And I gave a talk about psychoactive substances, but I was unlike today, I was entirely focused on psychiatric drugs. And afterward, one of the law students came charging down at me like he was going to attack me. He ran up to me and he got in my face. He said, "You don't know what you're talking about. I couldn't have gotten through law school without cocaine." He turned around and ran off. Medication spellbinding. Medication. The third basic principle after the brain disabling principle and medication spellbinding is chronic brain impairment. And I've been leading toward this. All classes of psychiatric drugs, all psychoactive drugs most likely, with long-term exposure, cause a general dysfunction of the brain, sometimes measurable in cell death and shrinkage of the brain. We have studies of all the drugs I've talked about today, all classes, the antipsychotic stimulants, antidepressants, benzos and sedatives, mood stabilizers. There are studies showing cell death and atrophy of the brain. With the antipsychotics, it can show up in a month in animals or people. Animals or people. In Great Britain, being led by Joanna Moncrief, a wonderful academic, repositioned psychiatrist who points out that I was saying this in the 1980s and documenting it in my peer-reviewed articles in the 80s, that it's really uncontestable that the antipsychotics are causing shrinkage of brain tissue and cell death. She led a group of well-intentioned psychiatrists in Great Britain to try to get their academy to at least allow a seminar on this, given the vast literature, which again I cite in my article, which you can get on my website, Rational Principles of Psychotherapy, and get a lot more detail in my new book, newest medical book, Principles. My newest medical book, which is Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. Now, if I were giving this speech in public now, I'd get a glass of water, I'd strut around, I'd rest a little and kid with the audience before I did my last 15 minutes. But I don't have that opportunity. I'm going to take a sip of water, folks. I want to repeat this. I'm not going to have time to go into it in detail. For every class of psychiatric drug, there is long-term evidence of impaired cell function, cell death, and atrophy of the brain. This is true, I gotta hate to even say it, for the stimulants we give children, for the antidepressants we give children and adults, and of course stimulants to adults too. For the antipsychotics, it shows up within a month or so. And it's also for the benzos and the mood stabilizers. And all of this I'm calling chronic brain impairment. You lose your cognitive abilities. You lose your overall quality of life. Your emotions become unstable. You become irritable and anxious, often angry. And you don't understand what's happening because you are suffering usually, not always, from some degree of medication spellbinding. So that you think you really do need the drugs when you don't. And you don't really fully realize the decline in your quality of life. It's more likely one of your loved ones is going to tell you that you're really, really a different person now, because knowing you're a different person is blocked by the drugs. Just as it is with drugs like marijuana long term, which make people less motivated, less driven, less ambitious, but also less able to be really engaged with other human beings. And then there's the beginning of cognitive decline, long term. Wow, it's a lot to tell you in an hour. Now, what about the effectiveness of the drugs? We have now had desperate, massive studies, desperately put together with pro-drug people to try to show that the antipsychotics, the stimulants, and the antidepressants really, really, really work, even though no one's shown it yet. Well, you say, when drugs are FDA approved, doesn't that show they're effective? Well, if you're not familiar with my work, get ready for one of the biggest disillusionments in life. When the FDA approved Adderall for children, the new Adderall XR form for children, you know how long they tested it on children? This drug you're supposed to take for months and years and maybe the rest of your life, they tested it for 3 weeks. It's a sham. It's a fraud. Why do they only test it for three weeks? Because they know they can't show it'll work at 4, 5, 6, and 7. Because the brain fights back and the kids get worse. But for the first 3 weeks, you can adequately suppress behavior. Remember, the drugs crush spontaneous behavior and cause OCD. For a few weeks, that looks good. But if you're actually watching the kids carefully in a controlled clinical trial, it doesn't work. Prozac, the miracle drug. Wow, it was supposed to be studied for 6 weeks, but they couldn't even get through to 6 weeks because the adverse effects were so bad, most of the people didn't stay beyond 4. So the FDA let them approve it for 4 weeks, but even that didn't work because so many patients were getting agitated. So against its own rules, the FDA, to get Prozac approved, allowed the company to use 2 trials in which they had cheated by giving the agitated patients benzos and other sedatives. I'm not lying. I can't be lying. You can imagine the repercussions for me saying this, writing about this, documenting this for so many years, if I weren't telling you the truth. So it's just all a fake. With the antipsychotics, the supposedly most effective drugs in the world, the FDA allows a fraud beyond imagination. It allows the drug companies to never test the drugs on acutely psychotic patients. That is, patients who are labeled schizophrenic when they come to the hospital for the first time. It allows them not to ever test them on that. They test them on patients who are often captives in state mental hospitals, on drugs, psychiatric drugs for years, on antipsychotics for years, on multiple drugs for years. Then they put the poor souls into acute withdrawal, which is horrible, coming off all these drugs. And then if the test drug is better than placebo for getting them out of withdrawal, they approve it. I don't lie. So every time a youngster with a psychotic break goes into a mental hospital and, of course, is put on antipsychotics, the doctor doesn't even know. It's never been tested for that by the FDA and probably nowhere else. That's how bad it is. But it's even worse because now there have been follow-up studies in desperation. And I'll briefly mention them. You can Google them. You can look them up on my website in my Rational Principles of Psychopharmacology. You can study them in more depth in psychiatric drug withdrawal. The study for the antipsychotic drugs is called CATIE. CATIE. It was an old buddy study. We're going to give a whole bunch of drugs to a whole bunch of patients in different places, and we're going to of the new antipsychotics, and then we're going to compare them to one of the older antipsychotics, which they hoped had really a lot of adverse effects, so that the new drugs would look good. So they showed one of the old antipsychotics. And what they found was that the drugs don't work, that almost everybody stops taking them. Now, they lied about the study for years while it was ongoing, but the final analysis was that the antipsychotic drugs produce as much, the newer ones, like Risperdal and Zyprexa and Abilify and Seroquel, the newer ones produce as much of the old neurological effects like acute spasms and painful dystonias and so on, as well as tardive dyskinesia, so they're just as bad. They're worse in that they produce a new syndrome, not new, but a syndrome that's called the a metabolic syndrome, which includes heart attack and increased cholesterol in your blood, diabetes, just a whole bunch of terrible things, hypertension and hypotension. And then finally, even Lieberman and other people involved in the study, and again, the sites are there, concluded that this is the emperor's new clothes. These drugs don't work. Yet they're poisoning people, masses of people. They're even being given to people for sleep. They're being given to children for fake bipolar disorder. Well, they did the same thing with the stimulants. They did a study. That was called CATIE, by the way, just reminding you, capital CATIE. Look up CATIE Lieberman. The stimulants, the MTA study, was again one of these old boy multiple site studies, let the cronies prove that stimulants work. For months they told us how great they are, for months. But 18 months later, no difference between taking stimulants and one couple of weeks at a nice summer camp. Hardly any difference from nothing at all. They don't work. Now, they didn't test for the adverse effects at all, hardly, except they measured weight and height, and that is suppressed permanently, as far as we know, by the drugs. That was proven again. They don't work, and they cause harm. Then there's the antidepressant study. That was called STAR-D. Capital letters again. This is a phenomena. S-T-A-R, and then one of those little stars up top, an asterisk, and then a capital D, star D. Well, a mere 2.7% of the people involved in the studies actually went on to show an improvement you could track. As for the benzos, everybody who knows anything knows that people get worse when they've been on them more than a few weeks. There's warnings about it, particularly in the Xanax label. And all of these drugs, including lithium, they all produce severe withdrawal reactions when you try to come off of them. All of them. So you can't come off them right away, folks. Don't listen to the show and stop your drugs. Look at my website. Got a warning at the bottom of it. You can't just stop taking these drugs because they're dangerous to start, dangerous to stop. They're particularly dangerous anytime you change the dose, up, down. And it's in the labels. I was saying that decades ago, it's finally in the labels, at least for the antidepressants. It's getting stronger and stronger in the benzo labels. Soon, maybe it'll be in, it's somewhat in the stimulant labels. I mean, someday, maybe it'll be everywhere where it should be, but it ain't so now. Listen, I've really enjoyed this. This is my first really one-hour enthusiastic talk given to my radio listening audience. Send this around, folks. This is something that everybody should get. And I want to close with two quick thoughts. One, if you're a psychotherapist, don't worry about telling the truth about psychiatric drugs to your patients. I'm very involved in as an expert in litigation. There are either none or so few, I've never seen one, where a psychotherapist has been sued for honestly discussing drugs, giving books to the client, giving literature to the client. Of course, you can't tell your client, come off the drugs. You tell them it's dangerous to come off them, get some supervision. But, and I think it's the moral obligation of all of us in serving our patients. It's the moral obligation of us to tell folks that there are dangers involved. The people who are getting sued are not you. That's why your insurance isn't high. The people who are getting sued are the psychiatrists for giving the drugs. They're the ones getting sued. So that's my big message to therapists. Be honorable. Be ethical. Besides, life is the only way to live life. Don't kowtow to the prescriber. My God, don't get your patient to do medication compliance, complying with a prescription by somebody who doesn't know what they're doing, because they're just listening to the drug rep? Don't do that, folks. Stand up for yourselves. Be honorable. And if you're working in an institution, be prepared to get fired. I'll admit that if you're working in an institution. So start on a private practice. It is great to treat people on your own. Now, there's tons of wonderful new effective treatments. I'm probably not going to have time to mention this at all today much. But even for psychosis, there's the Open Dialogue. You can Google that, which shows how marvelously well people do with family interventions without psychiatric drugs. My own approach is to treat people as much as possible as a family, unless the family is destructive beyond repair, which happens in severe cases of child abuse and sometimes with psychotic people. But very often in my practice, certainly, the people who come to me really want to help the identified patient, who's usually a child or a parent or a grandparent. Get the family together, mutual support, love, care, with wise counseling is the answer. People need people. They don't need pills. Thank you for listening today.